It's Tuesday, April 16th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Donald Trump is on trial, a legal proceeding without precedent. Only Donald Trump thinks there is a historical figure worthy of comparison.
I've been indicted more than Al Capone.
Al Capone, more than Al Capone. I can't stop saying it. I do it a little like Dice Man. Al Capone. Hey. Are we disgusted by the notorious gangster Al Capone? Not necessarily.
Alphonse Capone, the great Alphonse Capone.
He loves rolling that Alphonse in his mouth. Alphonse Capone, the great Alphonse Capone. Trump likes to put him in historical context for his crowds.
Remember this, I've been indicted more than Alphonse Capone, Mr. President. Do you know who that is? Even the president just said, I do. Scarface, Al Capone.
If it was half true, it would be more true than Trump's claims he was indicted more than Al Capone. Trump was actually indicted not more, but fewer times. Capone in a bodyguard was arrested in Philadelphia for carrying concealed weapons, served time in the county prison in Holmesburg. Capone was found guilty of contempt of court charges, sentenced to 6 months in Cook County Jail, that's Illinois. Of course, every time you serve jail, you are convicted and indicted. And then in 31, he was indicted for tax evasion for failing to file a return in 1924. Then a few months later, he was indicted on charges for tax evasion from 25 and 29. And then a few days after that, he was indicted on one count of conspiracy to violate the Prohibition Act. I think I've just listed five. An expert on Al Capone said it was six. But Trump notes that all of these indictments got him a little confused, and it was just unfair he wasn't prepared for this given his education.
I was never indicted. I didn't know. When they taught me at the Wharton School of Finance, they didn't talk about indictment.
Maybe not. Today, Wharton has a very popular legal studies and business ethics concentration within the Wharton School of Business, maybe because a few famous or infamous alumni have brought a good deal of ignominy upon the institution. Not as much shame as the truly notorious figures in public life, Al Capone. But I do have to think that the inability to distinguish infamy from actual accomplishment is fairly troubling. And maybe that can't even be taught. You just have to hope that your students aren't psychopaths coming in or going out. On the show today, one of the most difficult things in modern life. It's not accessing the truth. It's not rejecting lies. It's discernment. Discernment. Sometimes you hear, how difficult is it not to just fall for a lie? Well, we have a case study in crime rates. But first, Arwa Damon is a former CNN international journalist, 18 years on that job, and she covered wars in Iraq. She covered the Syrian Civil War and the international military intervention against ISIL. She is now the president and founder of the humanitarian organization INARA. And she's just back from a trip to Gaza to talk about what she saw and what the citizens of Gaza need from the international community and from Israel in terms of aid, in terms of inspections, in terms of border crossings. Now, we do have to say this was meant to be a one-on-one interview, but I wound up interviewing three guests because Arwa's cats, Tabasco and Nutmeg, were eager to chime in. And I have to say, Nutmeg's interpretation of UN Resolution 242 was eye-opening, but it wasn't germane to the issue, so it had to be edited out. Nevertheless, Arwa Damon up next.
Hi, this is Rachel Yucatel, and I'm here to invite you to listen to my podcast, Misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. This podcast delves into the lives of those who have been reduced to a single headline. Each episode will take a closer look at the stories of those who are on a mission to change their narrative. Join me as we uncover the truth behind the misconceptions, shed light on the stories of those who have perhaps been wrongfully portrayed, explore the complexities of the human experience, and celebrate the power of second chances. Who doesn't love a good comeback story?
Arwa Damon is an ex-CNN senior correspondent, and she is also now the president and founder of INARA. They're an aid organization helping war-wounded children. Their mission is to fill in the gaps in access to life-altering services for children in communities impacted by human-induced and natural disasters. Of course, the war in Gaza is a human-induced disaster. Arwa is just returned from Gaza to her home in Turkey, and we're going to talk about the situation there. Hi, welcome to The Gist.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
So the Israeli military does admit to serious mistakes in the killing of 7 food aid workers. What steps do you consider to be the minimum for Israel to address this serious, tragic, to take them at their word, mistake?
I think Israel needs to start taking this whole deconfliction process a lot more seriously. I got into Gaza 2 days after that strike on the World Central Kitchen convoy, along with a number of other humanitarian workers. And it was a very anxiety-ridden experience because all we could talk about was the WCK strike. And the reason why that was especially jarring compared to, you know, other hits or fatalities that have occurred within the humanitarian community, and there have been many, is because the WCK arguably had the best deconfliction process with the Israelis. They have lines of communication to the Israeli side. They've been able to accomplish some pretty, you know, amazing things in building the port and getting food aid to the north. And if deconfliction wasn't working for them, what did that mean for everybody else? Because if you're not the WCK, then you are really struggling trying to get assistance where it needs to go, because deconfliction has not and does not work in Gaza right now.
Right. So other aid organizations have a track record that in many cases the Israelis do not like. There is bad blood, for instance, between UNRWA and the Israelis, and WCK was invited by Israel. And this deconfliction you speak of, this is the term of art for notifying the authorities and working within a war zone so that aid workers operate outside or within the conflict, but outside risk.
Correct. So in nuts and bolts terminology, it's informing warring parties of intent to deliver somewhere and determining in coordination with the warring parties the best routes to be able to get there to ensure safe access for humanitarian organizations. And speak to anyone who's not the World Central Kitchen, and the vast majority of those requests are denied.
So, well, I'll ask you bluntly, do you think there's evidence that this was an intentional strike?
It's always hard to tell. And also one's mind doesn't want to actually absorb, you know, and accept this information that, you know, aid could so intentionally be targeted. But the same goes for, you know, the journalists that have been targeted inside Gaza. And so on the one hand, you know, you have what the Israelis have been saying, and they have been to a certain degree much more forthcoming in terms of what they say their investigation found. I think it goes to the crux of a lot of things that are very fundamentally wrong with the way that Israel is conducting this war. Its reliance on artificial intelligence, the lack of chain of command when it comes to actually approving strikes. If we compare Gaza to, say, a battle space like Mosul, or even Iraq in general over the course of, you know, the nearly 2 decades that the U.S. was there, strikes had to be approved pretty high up the chain of command. Israel has eliminated that entire approval process and is relying on artificial intelligence. But then we also have to look at what is actually happening on the ground and the fact that hundreds of aid workers and journalists have been killed in strikes.
Yeah, so the argument for it being intentional is something like Netanyahu and members of his cabinet want to terrorize Gazans, and sieges have worked throughout history. The argument against it is they're not stupid. They know that it would lead to and has led to horrible publicity that would redound in the difficulty of their pursuing their military aims. And I just bring that all up, not even say, let's weigh in on it. What do you think? But doesn't the answer, knowing the answer, having a strong inclination as to what the answer is, doesn't it have a great impact on the strategy of getting in the aid? In other words, if you know that the occupying force is intent on killing aid workers or denying the aid, you would go about trying to get the aid in a much different way than spending all this time in working with the Israelis if it's never the intent of them to make you safe.
And to answer that completely bluntly, there is so little trust right now in the Israeli government that even if it were to be 100% determined to be an accident, it wouldn't change the level of risk to aid workers or the level of anxiety with which humanitarian assistance is being carried out, because there is no rhyme or reason to this battle space. And I've been in battle spaces for, you know, the last 20 years. There is no way to fully 100% determine how to carry out your humanitarian missions safely. And, you know, having been there, you know, you're driving around these streets that are extraordinarily crowded in the south, and Rafah's population has swelled from like 270,000 up to, like, you know, some estimates have it at 1.4 million. And I distinctly remember staring at these crowds of people, and then an ambulance goes by, and I tensed up because ambulances have been hit in the past. I would constantly be scanning around me trying to guesstimate if, you know, this AI that Israel is reportedly using is going to determine that maybe something around me is a weapon and thereby such create a target. And that's the level of anxiety that Gazans are living with on a regular basis, irrespective of what it is that they are doing.
When you were with CNN, you covered many of these war zones. Were you in Mosul, for instance?
I was in Mosul. Yeah, I was. So I've actually covered a lot of these battles that, you know, you're hearing a lot of these military analysts talk about. And, you know, a lot of them, frankly, haven't set foot in either of those battle zones. But I was on the ground in Fallujah 2004. And, you know, I covered the lead up to the Mosul offensive extensively, and then the actual offensive itself in 2016.
So just contrast it. That's a good contrast to me, or at least I think the best one we could reach for. You can't contrast getting aid to people in Gaza during this war with some other situation that isn't an active war zone or isn't as violent and unpredictable. But what about Mosul? Was it appreciably different? The United States, who was trying to unseat ISIS from an urban setting, it was what, night and day, or just many degrees different in terms of the coordination between the United States and relief organizations?
So here's the thing to take into consideration, and let's put it in this framework, the framework of who controls the skies, meaning who controls the bombs that are falling. What you had in Mosul was a population of roughly 2 million that was effectively under siege by ISIS, not permitted to leave by ISIS, that was actually being held at gunpoint in their homes by ISIS fighters who were not permitting them to leave. Let's compare that to Gaza. Israel controls the skies, and Israel is what is limiting Gazans' abilities to leave. And Hamas is not holding people at gunpoint in their homes. There was no line of communication to ISIS, and as such, no ability to negotiate anything. There are lines of communication, albeit imperfect, to Hamas at this stage and an ability to negotiate something. So that's on one side. Now let's talk about what happens to the civilian population. In Mosul, once the Iraqi army was advancing on the ground and, in quotations, liberating certain areas from ISIS, the civilian population was able to flee. And the minute the civilian population was able to flee this danger zone, aid organizations were able to obviously jump into action and provide shelter, food, water, medicine. In Gaza, there is no fleeing the war zone.
Right. So the major difference is there is no strategy of liberation from the Israeli side. And that's a major difference. And that has a big effect on how the aid picture looks.
Yeah. And it's not just, you know, strategy of liberation or whatever you want to call it. It's that there is no safe space.
How much will the opening of the Erez crossing help get more aid into Gaza?
It will help if actual humanitarian convoys are able to go in a sustainable and highly scaled up manner with the appropriate staff to be able to distribute the aid. And I was actually just messaging with some of my friends in Gaza who have friends up north. And, you know, trucks have gone in through Erez in the last few days. But this is what was interesting. There were, it would seem, commercial trucks. So they're not distributing for free. These are commercial trucks that are distributing produce to the market. Is that a good thing? Yes. But does it really work right now? No. And so one of the messages we got from, you know, someone who lives up north is that what it has done, for example, is take the price of chicken from what it was up north, which was 180 shekels, which is like $50, and brought it down to the equivalent of around $15. Gaza, the north, yes, of course, they need anything that they can get. But realistically speaking, you have a population that has absolutely no money, that is on, you know, the brink of starvation, under threat of being in famine, and expected to pay astronomical prices for what's coming in on these commercial trucks.
Do you have any visibility as to the issue of Israeli inspections? Because the charges and the countercharges, Israel saying we must inspect these trucks because contraband can get in there, and that's certainly true. On the other hand, relief organizations and Hamas are alleging that Israel is purposefully dragging feet, holding things up, or adhering to a standard that doesn't make sense, given even if you acknowledge legitimate security concerns. What do you know about that?
Right. So if we look at the average duration it takes for a truck to be inspected and then actually physically cross into Gaza itself and get to a warehouse in Gaza, fast is a week. Mm-hmm. Average is 2 weeks. So that's not quick enough. The other issue that we face as aid organizations is we don't actually have clear guidelines on what post-October 7th is now considered to be a restricted item.
Right. So you want to pack the truck correctly to speed this along, and there's ambiguity as to what the definition of correctly is.
Correct. So what you have is this, you know, list of restricted items that has existed since 2008, both for Gaza and for the West Bank, although the list for Gaza is significantly more heavily restricted. And these are all considered to be dual use items. So we obviously know that those items cannot go in. What has emerged post October 7th is this strange process whereby which items that are not on that 2008 list are being turned back. Mm-hmm. But we cannot for the life of us get an updated set of guidance or guidelines from the Israeli side. And so what has happened is that over time, as similar items have been rejected over and over again, you simply stop trying to send them in. And this can range from, you know, things that don't necessarily make a huge amount of sense, but you're like, okay, whatever, like nail clippers that would be, you know, put inside hygiene kits,
yeah,
to other things like, you know, solar panels, crutches, wheelchairs, pediatric insulin pens, solar powered refrigerators. I mean, it goes on and on and on. You know, there's reports that, you know, another organization tried to send in children's toys. Those were turned back. You know, we're trying to put together a dignity and hygiene kit for mass distribution. And we're sitting there debating if we think, you know, oh, is shampoo and conditioner going to get through? You know, have trucks with that gone through in the past? You know, what can we actually add to this? Obviously, okay, so we're not going to try to put a nail file in it or nail clippers because we know that those have been turned back.
What about the Egyptian side, the Rafah crossing? Since this is the call of the Egyptians, is it as hard and opaque to get things through there?
It's not the Egyptians' call. It's the Israelis' call. Mm-hmm. Every single truck that goes through Rafah in Egypt crosses first to Israel to be searched. And then it crosses back to Egypt, which is why it takes such a long amount of time. The trucks are loaded up in Egypt. They then drive into Israel. They get searched by the Israeli side at two locations. There's Kerem Shalom, where it gets searched, but then there's also another checkpoint up north. Then they go back into Egypt, and then they cross into Rafah, and they get cross-loaded in sort of no man's land into a Palestinian truck, and then continue into Gaza itself and into a warehouse. No truck enters Gaza without first being searched by the Israelis. No person enters or exits Gaza, even from Egypt, without first being approved by the Israelis.
And it is your conclusion that their inspection process is not only frustrating, but, well, I don't want to put words in your mouth. It's frustrating to the point where you have to question their intentions. Is that right?
One does have to question their intentions because there is no logical reason why, given the sheer severity of the situation inside, more is not getting in. There is no conclusion other than the fact that it is intentional.
So if Israel wanted to earn themselves some good PR in the eyes of the world, what could they do? That, and I know you're not an Israel military planner, that you would also acknowledge should not interfere with their military aims.
So I'm not a military planner, but I've been in a lot of military spaces.
Yeah. And you know what the concerns are, and you know what legitimate concerns are.
So yeah, if Israel really did want to show, you know, positive intent, they could very quickly and very easily open up more checkpoints, more crossings into Gaza, allow for a greater number of trucks to enter, allow for more humanitarian personnel to enter. You have to realize that everybody inside is absolutely and totally exhausted. They could begin to actually take concrete measures towards proving to Gazans that they will be able to return back to their homes. This is one thing that Gazans are terrified of, that they're never going to be able to go back. You have bodies that are still underneath the rubble in a number of locations whose loved ones are unable to access them. You have a need for, you know, sewage plants to come back online. You have a need for water to come back online. In fact, one thing that Israel could do right now immediately to prove good intent would be to turn the electricity and water to Gaza back on. That has been shut off for 6 months.
Right. But that has, I mean, they would argue that there is a military, there is a clear military component of that. Who would that benefit and who would siphon off so much of that electricity would be Hamas.
I mean, honestly, let them siphon. What are they going to do with the electricity?
Oh,
keep their lights on?
Well, I know what the argument is, which is that if you can deny Hamas the electricity to power their generators, then the tunnels become much less usable. You know, the air in the tunnels.
They're not powering their generators with electricity. Their generators are powered by fuel and by whatever. I mean, but that's the other thing also, right? So this goes back to this whole policy of, you know, collective punishment. You cannot punish an entire population for a crime carried out by one organization. And if you want to keep the electricity off and maintain that argument that Hamas is going to benefit from it militarily, then at least let in a significant number of solar panels so that the rest of Gaza is not sitting in the dark. Because I can tell you from my own experience of being there, I was trying to conserve backup battery power one night. And so I was sitting in the dark and it was terrifying. All you hear are the drones overhead. All you hear are explosions in the distance. The windows are rattling. It's pitch black outside, and you have children, toddlers, sitting in tents under these conditions.
As a veteran of many war zones, were you more afraid in Gaza than you'd ever been?
I was telling someone else this earlier. So back in 2012, I did a trip with CNN into this area.
The fade out. So we give you the interview that we would have aired if there wasn't this option called Pesca Plus. I always go long on interviews. So I wanted to give you access to all of that should you choose to join us at Pesca Plus. And in this part of the interview, we're going to talk about making the transition from journalist to advocate, to humanitarian work, what she found was similar about it. We'll also talk about the issue of famine. You can subscribe and listen to all that and get ad-free podcasting at subscribe.mikepesca.com. And now the spiel. Murder is down significantly in most U.S. cities. It's not down everywhere. One of our most murderous cities, Washington, D.C., stubbornly bucked the national trend of murder decline in 2023. But preliminary data from the nation's capital indicates that crime and murder is falling there, too. Yay. There are a couple of caveats, including the FBI changing its collection methods, and also a one-year murder blip can be communicated as up or down, but a tiny decrease after a massive increase, that does not warrant the message, crime is down. But that's not what really is going on. Crime is down significantly, enough that we could say that huge rise, that literally unprecedented rise in murder that we saw in 2020 is being made up for. We're back to pre-pandemic levels or are on a trend to be so. There are a couple other caveats to this. One is that, one, a communicator can overemphasize historical numbers or underemphasize them. In the underemphasized category, here is New York Mayor Eric Adams talking about historic claims. This was back in a 2022 interview.
These guns are endless on our street. I've never witnessed anything like this before in my professional career.
As someone who is a police officer in the 1990s knows, murders topped 2,000 in a year then. Last year, they were below 400. So that statement is sheer wackiness. But an over-reliance on historical context is also a way to explain away that big one-year rise in murders. Very concerning. It's true. Things aren't or weren't as bad as they were 30 years ago. True, but irrelevant to everyone who's 29 and under, but also just to anyone who's living in a gun-infested neighborhood where that person's life is at stake. Do a comparison to 1990. I mean, that is not something we do for other stats like childbirth, mortality, or lifespan. Both of those stats have been improved upon since 1990, but I think you're right to say, so what? It's not as good as it could be. Just look at other developed nations. Just like today, people in Chicago or Philadelphia or places that are relatively unsafe compared to the world can say, well, things aren't as good as we know they can be because we were a bit safer or a lot safer a couple years ago. All right. The truth about crime is that it's declining. It is absolutely declining now. And I say crime, but murder is the most important crime to criminologists. It is, of course, the most serious crime, but also it has this quality of almost never going unreported. Property crimes, violent crimes have a 30 to 50% rate of being unreported, according to survey data, compared to murder rates. Murders aren't always solved, but we almost always know about them. The decline in crime is, of course, a good thing, except for the fact that Americans don't believe it. And one reason that people don't believe it is that people never believe it. Polling always shows that Americans always believe that crime rates are getting worse. But you'll also hear another explanation that citizens don't believe that crime has declined and declined significantly because it is our political opponents who are misleading us. Here, MSNBC on a recent couple months ago primary night offering an analysis of the crime decline.
I mean, all the programming about cities, the spread of crime and
meanwhile, on Earth One, the FBI reports that violent crime in America is at a 50-year low.
And migrant crime is not a thing.
And migrant crime is not a thing.
Now, migrant crime is, of course, a thing, ask the families of those killed by migrants, but all the best research does show that migrants engage in less violent crime than legal residents, which is what the MSNBC host meant if you were to extend maximum leeway for hyperbole. But, you know, the overall point that violent crime is or at a 50-year low, or to quote the researcher, Jeff Asher, who was on my show, who came up with that stat, he says close to a 50-year low. That's true. Murder, however, is not at a 50-year low. It was lower 20 years ago by a little bit. It was lower, I'd say significantly lower for the decade between around 2008 and 2019. Yeah, I know that's 12 years. But anyway, MSNBC just got it right. And you got to ask yourself, is it that hard? Not that they're perfect. No one's perfect. But maybe we should just say when the mainstream media tells us that there are stats and stats show that murder is down, let's just credit the non-ideological media, CNN, MSNBC, the networks. They're going to just lie to us. You heard it right there. Except for the migrant crime is not a thing part. Let's chalk that up to hyperbole. You know what they were saying. So far in this discussion, I call it a spiel, I have armed you in a way that Eric Adams had never witnessed, I suppose. I've armed you with some tools, some touchstones to assess the truth that crime is declining. The fact is that crime is declining. And the fact is that persistent perceptions will mislead you to think that it's not, or mislead some of your fellow Americans. And I suppose inaccurate actors, watch out for them. They're going to also lie to you. But here's the thing. back when murders were setting all the bad kinds of records, when they were rising, you know what the credible, non-ideological media, not all of it, but much of it was telling us? It was telling us it just wasn't true. It just wasn't the case. It was doing it through little tricks and habits of rhetoric, but they know what they were doing. And I'm talking about the same outlets. So here's an MSNBC segment presented by Tiffany Cross. The year was 2021. It was July of 2021. And this is a segment they ran called Make It Make Sense. And the specific name of this one is Fear-mongering and Misinformation in News Coverage of Crime Rates. So they start by playing a quote from a Fox News segment.
So why is the White House ignoring the rising crime rate across the country?
All right, Ashley, thanks for that excellent, although extremely loaded question. To be fair, I can see how anybody watching Fox might get the idea every American city is bullet-ridden battlefield of burnt-out cars and trash fires. I mean, just look at how Fox and Newsmax frame any coverage of crime rates in the United States.
The surge in crime.
A rising crime.
A surge in crime.
Crime wave.
Surge in crime.
Crime wave. Rising crime rate.
Surge in crime.
Crime wave. Full-scale crime wave.
Massive crime wave.
Rising crime wave.
Massive lie wave.
Quippy. I mean, who doesn't hate Fox, right? They did reference a crime wave all those times, did Fox. They said crime wave, crime wave. There is a lot of crime wave. But guess what? This was the year after America reported the largest single rise in murders since they've been recording murders. Crime was up. Criminologists, police forces, communities, mayors, Democrat and Republican, anyone with an interest in lowering the number of dead bodies was noticing that crime was up. They were very upset about it. We're talking about, at the time that this segment ran, thousands and thousands of more Americans, the majority of them African-American men, who were dead, who would have just been, if it weren't for this massive increase in murders, who'd be walking around enjoying life. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe just getting in fistfights and being jerks, but not getting murdered. This is a fact, even if Fox agrees and talked a lot about how it was a fact. Cross goes on.
Yes, violent crimes, which also include murder, ticked up by 3% last year, and very early data from this year shows that trend may continue. Obviously, we all want crime to keep dropping, as it has been for 26 of the last 28 years. But you guys, let's keep it real. A 3% increase in anything is hardly a surge.
But coming on the heels of the largest increase in recorded history, yes, that is a surge. She was speaking again in 2021. Which would go down as the most murderous year of this century. This idea that crime was coming down when it was going up was legion at the time. Here is an MSNBC video, a TikTok by a guy named Manny Fidel, and he's helping orient viewers who might think that the record-setting murder rise followed by another rise is perhaps a legitimate thing to worry about?
This doesn't mean you shouldn't be worried about crime. But whenever Republicans are losing their minds about something around the midterms, chances are they're just trying to scare you into voting for them.
That was labeled, quote, Republican hypocrisy on crime rates. Hypocrisy. I guess New York gubernatorial candidate Lee Zeldin said he was tough on crime, but you know what he was doing in his spare time? He was murdering people. Not to pick on MSNBC, here is a CBS analysis of the rise in murders in advance of the 2022 midterms. They had on Jeff Pegues, who does have a neurological condition that causes his voice to sound strained. You might be asking yourself about that. But pay attention to his analysis of the many instances of crimes in New York where people were being attacked or pushed in front of trains.
And then in New York, for example, you lately have a number of incidents involving the transit system, and so it's all over the local news, and so it gives off this sense of a city that is unsafe, which historically speaking is really not the case. But that's how people vote.
People should, in fact, I would say, vote on their circumstances, and New Yorkers were living through a fairly big uptick in crime. In 2020, murders went up by 150 more dead New Yorkers. By the time Pagés was talking, it was 2022, those murders had not returned close to pre-pandemic levels. And if I will change the terms of my debate, I've been trying to stick to murders, but just crime in general from 21 to 22 was up by over 10%. Another anchor during that segment asked him to analyze the latest national murder stats. Pagés obliged.
Let's talk a little bit about this, the murder rate.
And though there's a lag, and so I'm not sure exactly how to interpret it, it went up, but just by a little bit, certainly compared to the year before, where there was an increase. It's 1/6 of what it was the year before. Is this a promising statistic then, if the rate of murders going up is slowing, or can we not even compare the 2 years?
I personally think it's encouraging.
Okay.
Well, it's not. If you want murder to come down, and we all do, then you should start with the idea that murder should be declining. That would be an indication of it coming down. It seems maybe a subtle point. I'm not trying to be overly broad here, right? One could look at this and say, well, when rates decrease, isn't the next thing that happens is rates decline? Isn't that a natural precondition? You might think, but that's just not the case and not usually how it works with murder. Usually murders come down by a lot all of a sudden. Let's take 1988 in New York. Almost 1,900 people were murdered. That was an increase of 13.4% from the year prior. But the next year, there were only 9 more murders. Wow, the murder rate was coming down. 1990 should be a great year. In fact, it was the most murderous year in New York City history. 2,245 killed. Murder increasing just isn't murder coming down. I'm not being pedantic. If you were to say, as a public official, our methods are working or conditions are improving, then you would need to see fewer murders, not more. Take a city, and I'll go by, roughly speaking, the national crime stats. 1 year, 2019, 100 people in your city are murdered. The next year, it's 130. The year after that, it's 135, and then it's 138. Well, that's not a city at that point that reflects a decrease in murder rate. The mayor of that city is not saying what we're doing is working. The mayor is probably saying we may have reached a new sad normal. Murder isn't like inflation. There's no natural rate of murder built into the system that we kind of need to make it work out. I don't think the news media would use the slightly lower rate of increase as a example of progress in an area where they're not rooting for a certain outcome. Take the rise in global temperatures. I've heard many years of reporting where they say the last few years, the last 10 years are the warmest on record. That's true. It's a problem. They never say, but the increase this year was at a lower rate than the increase in some prior years. And that sometimes is true. By the way, not for 2023. This is by far the hottest year and the biggest rise ever. But what I'm saying is, with murder, it is in the interests of the communicator to try to mitigate facts or to allay concerns. Before the 2022 midterms, there was a lot of that mitigation and allaying going on. Crime's not so bad. Murder increased by just a little. There was a time when murder was worse. Some of you may even have been alive during that time. You know, that's a consolation. And sorry, but pre-2022, the midterms, the solutions that politicians were proposing, they might not have been the ones talking the most about the rise in crime. Even the solutions Fox was proposing, they might have been bad solutions, non-solutions, cruel solutions, ineffective solutions, solutions playing on the worst angels of our nature. But the facts were that crime was a concern because crime was a concern, a legitimate concern. It was still trending up after an historic increase. Now it's 2024. We can say that crime, specifically murder, is going down. And we should say that because that is the truth. The problem is, if you want your fellow citizens to believe that, well, one problem is that they almost never believe that. Bake that into your calculation. But B, the messengers were so busy working overtime to deny parts of that reality. I don't need to put before you more facts, more stats, more clips. Just listen, every time this election cycle that the media or a politician talks about the big decrease in crime over the last couple years, they're right. And you might say to yourself, if you challenge yourself to remember, wait, I thought they were already saying that. I thought that already happened in 2022. It did not happen then. That's why we could say it's happened now. And we can finally say it with accuracy and credibility. But no one is out there apologizing for having burned up a portion of that credibility a couple years back. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is in charge of special projects for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with AdvertiseCast, Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. In fact, for advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umpru, Jeepru, Dupru. Thanks for listening.